saddlebags, Aragorn outfitted himself in the bright dress of war. First he pulled his hauberk over his elven tunic, then strapped his chased greaves to his legs and his inlaid braces to his forearms. On his head went his padded leather cap, followed by his coif of tempered steel, and then his gold and silver helm. Last of all, he replaced his regular gloves with his mail-backed gauntlets. Zarok he hung on his left hip, using the belt of Beloth the Wise. Across his back he placed the quiver of white swan feathers Islanzadi had given him. The quiver, he was pleased to find, could also hold the bow the Elf Queen had sung for him, even when it was strung. After depositing his and Oryk's belongings into the pavilion, Aragorn and Saphira set out together to find Triana, the current leader of Duvrangar Gata. They had gone no more than a few paces, when Aragorn sensed a nearby mine that was shielded from his view. Assuming that it was one of the Varden's magicians, they veered toward it. 12 yards from their starting point, they came upon a small green tent, with a donkey picketed in front. To the left of the tent, a blackened iron cauldron hung from a metal tripod, placed over one of the malodorous flames berthed deep within the earth. Cords were strung about the cauldron, over which were draped nightshade, hemlock, rhododendron, savin, bark of the yew tree, and numerous mushrooms, such as deathcap and spotted court, all of which Aragorn recognized from Oromus's lessons on poison. And standing next to the cauldron, wielding a long wood paddle with which she stirred the brew, was Angela, the herbalist. At her feet sat Solemnbum. The weercat uttered a mournful meow, and Angela looked up from her task, her corkscrew hair forming a billowing thundercloud around her glistening face. She frowned, and her expression became positively ghoulish, for it was lit from beneath by the flickering green flame.
"So you've returned, eh?"
"We have," said Aragorn.
"Is that all you have to say for yourself? Have you seen Elva yet? Have you seen what you did to that poor girl?"
"I?"
cried Angela. "How inarticulate can a person be? All this time in Ellesmere being tutored by the elves, and I is the best you can manage? Let me tell you something, blockhead. Anyone who is stupid enough to do what you did deserves—"
Aragorn clasped his hands behind his back and waited, as Angela informed him in many explicit, detailed and highly inventive terms exactly how great a blockhead he was, what kind of ancestors he must possess to be such a monumental blockhead. She even went so far as to insinuate that one of his grandparents had mated with an Urgle, and the quite hideous punishments he ought to receive for his idiocy. If anyone else had insulted him in that manner, Aragorn would have challenged them to a duel. But he tolerated her spleen because he knew he could not judge her behaviour by the same standards as he did others, and because he knew her outrage was justified. He had made a dreadful mistake. When she finally paused for breath, he said, "You're quite right, and I'm going to try to remove the spell once the battle is decided." Angela blinked 3 times, one right after the other, and her mouth remained open for a moment in a small O before she clamped it shut. With a glare of suspicion, she asked, "You're not saying that just to placate me, are you?"
"I would never."
"And you really intend to undo your curse?"
"I thought such things were irrevocable."
"The elves have discovered many uses of magic."
"Ah, well then, that's settled, isn't it?"
She flashed him a wide smile and then strode past him to pat Saphira on her jowls.
"It's good to see you again, Saphira. You've grown."
"Well met indeed, Angela."
As Angela returned to stirring her concoction, Aragorn said, "That was an impressive tirade you gave."
"Thank you. I worked on it for several weeks. It's a pity you didn't get to hear the ending. It's memorable. I could finish it for you if you want."
"No, that's all right. I can imagine what it's like." Glancing at her out of the corner of his eye, Aragorn then said, "You don't seem surprised by how I've changed." The herbalist shrugged.
"I have my sources. It's an improvement, in my opinion. You were a bit, how shall I say it, unfinished before."
"That I was." He gestured at the hanging plants. "What do you plan to do with these?"
"Oh, it's just a little project of mine. An experiment, if you will."
Examining the pattern of colours on a dried mushroom that dangled before him, Aragorn asked, Did you ever figure out if toads exist or not? As a matter of fact, I did. It seems that all toads are frogs, but not all frogs are toads. So in that sense, toads don't really exist, which means that I was right all along. She stopped her patter abruptly, leaned to the side, grabbed a mug from a bench next to her, and offered it to Aragorn. Here, have a cup of tea. Aragorn glanced at the deadly plants surrounding them, and then back at Angela's open face before he accepted the mug. Under his breath, so the herbalist would not hear, he muttered three spells to detect poison. Only once he ascertained that the tea was free of contamination did he dare drink. The tea was delicious, though he could not identify the ingredients. At that moment, Solemnbum padded over to Saphira and began to arch his back and rub himself up against her leg, just as any normal cat would. Twisting her neck, Saphira bent down and with the tip of her nose brushed the weercat the length of his spine. She said,
"I met someone in Ellesmere who knows you."
Solemnbum stopped rubbing and cocked his head.
"Is that so?"
"Yes, her name was Quickpaw, and the Dream Dancer, and also Maud."
Solemnbum's golden eyes widened. A deep, throaty purr rumbled in his chest, and he rubbed against Saphira with renewed vigour.
"So," said Angela, "I assume you already spoke with Nasawada, Arya, and King Orin?" He nodded. "And what did you think of dear old Orin?"
Aragorn chose his words with care, for he was aware that they were talking about a king.
"Well, he seems to have a great many interests."
"Yes, he's as balmy as a moonstruck fool on Midsummer Night Eve. But then everyone is, in one way or another." Amused by her forthrightness, Aragorn said,
"He must be crazy to have carted so much glass all the way from Aberon."
Angela raised an eyebrow.
"What's this now? Haven't you seen the inside of his tent?"
"Unlike some people," she sniffed, "I don't ingratiate myself with every monarch I meet." So he described for her the mass of instruments Orin had brought to the Burning Plains. Angela abandoned her stirring as he spoke, and listened with great interest. The instant he finished, she began bustling around the cauldron, gathering the plants off the lines, often using tongs to do so, and saying,
"I think I had best pay Orin a visit. The two of you will have to tell me about your trip to Ellesmere at a later time. Well, go on, both of you. Be gone."
Aragorn shook his head as the short little woman drove him and Saphira away from her tent, and he still holding the cup of tea.
"Talking with her is always..."
"Different,"
suggested Saphira.
"Exactly."
The Clouds of War. From there it took them almost half an hour to locate Triana's tent, which apparently served as the unofficial headquarters of Duvrangar Gata. They had difficulty finding the tent because few people knew of its existence, and even fewer could tell them where it lay, because the tent was hidden behind a spur of rock that served to conceal it from the gaze of enemy magicians in Galbatorix's army. As Aragorn and Saphira approached the black tent, the entrance was thrust open and Triana strode out, her arms bare to the elbow in preparation to use magic. Behind her clustered a group of determined, if frightened-looking, spellcasters, many of whom Aragorn had seen during the battle in Farthendur, either fighting or healing the wounded. Aragorn watched as Triana and the others reacted with the now-expected surprise at his altered appearance. Lowering her arms, Triana said,
"Shadeslayer, Saphira, you should have told us sooner that you were here. We've been preparing to confront and battle what we thought was a mighty foe."
"I didn't mean to upset you," said Aragorn, "but we had to report to Nasawada and King Orin immediately after we landed."
"And why have you graced us with your presence now? You never deigned to visit us before, we who are more your brethren than any in the Varden."
"I've come to take command of Duvrangar Gata." The assembled spellcasters muttered with surprise at his announcement, and Triana stiffened. Aragorn felt several magicians probe his consciousness in an attempt to divine his true intentions. Instead of guarding himself, which would blind him to impending attacks, Aragorn retaliated by jabbing the minds of the would-be invaders hard enough that they retreated behind their own barriers. As he did, Aragorn had the satisfaction of seeing two men and a woman flinch and avert their gazes.
"By whose order?" demanded Triana.
"By Nasawada's."
"Ah," said the sorceress with a triumphant smile, "but Nasawada has no direct authority over us.
we helped the Varden of our own free will. Her resistance puzzled Aragorn. I'm sure Nasuada would be surprised to hear that, after everything she and her father have done for Dúvrangar Gata. It might give her the impression that you no longer wanted the support and protection of the Varden. He let the threat hang in the air for a moment. Besides, I seem to remember you were willing to give me this post before. Why not now?
Triana lifted an eyebrow.
You refused my offer, Shadeslayer, or have you forgotten?
Composed as she was, a trace of defensiveness coloured her response, and Aragorn suspected she knew her position was untenable. She seemed more mature to him than when they last met, and he had to remind himself of the hardships she must have endured since, marching across Alagaesia to Surda, supervising the magicians of Dúvrangar Gata and preparing for war.
We could not accept then. It was the wrong time.
Abruptly changing tack, she asked,
Why does Nasuada believe you should command us anyway? Surely you and Saphira would be more useful elsewhere.
Nasuada wants me to lead you, Dúvrangar Gata, in the coming battle, and so I shall.
Aragorn thought it best not to mention that it was his idea.
A dark scowl gave Triana a fierce appearance.
She pointed at the cluster of spellcasters behind her. We have devoted our lives to the study of our art. You have been casting spells for less than 2 years. What makes you more qualified for this task than any of us? No matter. Tell me, what is your strategy? How do you plan to employ us?
My plan is simple, he said. The lot of you will join minds and search for enemy spellcasters. When you find one, I'll add my strength to yours, and together we can crush the spellcaster's resistance. Then we can slay the troops that previously were protected by his or her wards.
And what will you be doing the rest of the time?
Fighting alongside Saphira.
After an awkward silence, one of the men behind Triana said,
It's a good plan.
He quailed as Triana cast an angry glare at him. She slowly faced Aragorn again.
Ever since the twins died, I have led Dúvrangar Gata. Under my guidance, they have provided the means to fund the Varden's war effort, ferreted out the Black Hand, Galbatorix's network of spies that tried to assassinate Nasuada, as well as performing innumerable other services. I do not boast when I say these are no mean accomplishments, and I'm certain I can continue to produce such results. Why, then, does Nasuada want to depose me? How have I displeased her?
Everything became clear to Aragorn then.
She has grown accustomed to power and doesn't want to surrender it. But more than that, she thinks that my replacing her is a criticism of her leadership.
You need to resolve this debate, and quickly too,
said Saphira.
Our time grows short.
Aragorn racked his brain for a way to establish his authority in Dúvrangar Gata without further alienating Triana. At last he said, I didn't come here to stir up trouble. I came to ask for your help. He spoke to the entire congregation, but looked only at the sorceress. I am strong, yes. Saphira and I could probably defeat any number of Galbatorix's pet magicians, but we cannot protect everyone in the Varden. We cannot be everywhere, and if the Empire's battle mages join forces against us, then even we will be hard-pressed to survive. We cannot fight this battle alone. You are quite right, Triana. You have done well with Dúvrangar Gata. And I'm not here to usurp your authority. It's only that, as a magician, I need to work with Dúvrangar Gata, and as a rider, I may also need to give you orders, orders that I have to know will be obeyed without question. The chain of command must be established. That said, you will retain the greater part of your autonomy. Most times I'll be too busy to devote my attention to Dúvrangar Gata, nor do I intend to ignore your counsel, for I'm aware that you have far more experience than I. So I ask again, will you help us, for the good of the Varden?
Triana paused, then bowed. Of course, Shadeslayer, for the good of the Varden. It will be an honour to have you lead Dúvrangar Gata.
Then let us begin. Over the next few hours, Aragorn talked with every one of the assembled magicians, although a fair number were absent, being occupied with one task or another to help the Varden. He did his best to acquaint himself with their knowledge of magic. He learned that the majority of men and women in Dúvrangar Gata had been introduced to their craft by a relative, and usually in profound secrecy, to avoid attracting attention from those who feared magic.
and of course Galbatorix himself. Only a handful had received proper apprenticeships. As a result, most of the spellcasters knew little about the ancient language. None could truly speak it fluently. Their beliefs about magic were often distorted by religious superstitions, and they were ignorant of numerous applications of grammary.
No wonder the twins were so desperate to extract your vocabulary of the ancient language when they tested you in Fardandur,
observed Saphira.
With it, they could have easily conquered these lesser magicians.
They're all we have to work with, though.
True. I hope you can see now I was right about Triana. She places her own desires before the good of the many.
You were right, he agreed, but I don't condemn her for it. Triana deals with the world in the best way she can, as do we all. I understand that, even if I don't approve. And understanding, as Oromis said, breeds empathy. A bit more than a third of the spellcasters specialized as healers. Those Eragon sent on their way after giving them a quintet of new spells to memorize, enchantments that would allow them to treat a greater range of injuries. The remaining spellcasters Eragon worked with to establish a clear chain of command. He appointed Triana his lieutenant and let her ensure that his orders were carried out, and to weld their disparate personalities into a cohesive fighting unit. Trying to convince magicians to cooperate, he discovered, was like trying to get a pack of dogs to share a meat bone. Nor did it help that they were in evident awe of him, for he could find no way of using his influence to smooth relations among the contentious magicians. In order to gain a better idea of their exact proficiency, Eragon had them cast a series of spells. As he watched them struggle with enchantments that he now considered simple, Eragon became aware of just how far his own powers had advanced. To Saphira, he marvelled, "And to think I once had trouble lifting a pebble in the air!"
"And to think," she replied, "Galbatorix has had over a century to hone his talent."
The sun was low in the west, intensifying the fermented orange light until the Vardan's camp, the livid Jeet River, and the entirety of the burning plains glowed in the mad marble effulgence as if in a scene from a lunatic's dreams. The sun was no more than a finger's breadth above the horizon when a runner arrived at the tent. He told Eragon that Nasawada ordered him to attend her at once.
"And I think you'd better hurry, Shadeslayer, if you don't mind me saying so."
After extracting a promise from Duvrangorgata that they would be ready and willing when he called upon them for assistance, Eragon ran alongside Saphira through the rows of grey tents towards Nasawada's pavilion. A harsh tumult above them caused Eragon to lift his eyes from the treacherous ground long enough to glance overhead. What he saw was a giant flock of birds wheeling between the two armies. He spotted eagles, hawks and falcons, along with countless greedy crows and their larger, dagger-beaked, blue-backed, rapacious cousin, the raven. Each bird shrieked for blood to wet its throat and enough hot meat to fill its belly and sate its hunger. By experience and instinct, they knew that whenever armies appeared in Alagazia, they could expect to feast on acres of carrion. "The clouds of war are gathering," observed Eragon.
Nargarjvog.
Eragon entered the pavilion, Saphira pushing her head through after him. He was met by a steely rasp as Jormunda and a half dozen of Nasuada's commanders drew their swords at the intruders. The men lowered their weapons as Nasuada said,
"Come here, Eragon."
"What is your bidding?" Eragon asked.
"Our scouts report that a company of some 100 Kull approach from the northeast."
Eragon frowned. He had not expected to encounter Urgals in this battle, since Durza no longer controlled them, and so many had been killed in Fardandur. But if they had come, they had come. He felt his bloodlust rise and allowed himself a savage grin as he contemplated destroying Urgals with his new strength. Clapping his hand to Zarok's hilt, he said, "It will be a pleasure to eliminate them. Saphira and I can handle it by ourselves if you want." Nasawada watched his face carefully as she said,
"We can't do that, Eragon. They're flying a white flag, and they have asked to talk with me."
Eragon gaped at her.
"Surely you don't intend to grant them an audience?"
"I will offer them the same courtesies I would to any foe who arrives under the banner of truce."
"They're brutes, though. Monsters. It's folly to allow them into the camp. Nasawada, I have seen the atrocities Urgals commit. They relish pain and suffering and deserve no more mercy than a rabid dog.
There is no need for you to waste time over what is surely a trap. Just give the word, and I and every last one of your warriors will be more than willing to kill these foul creatures for you."
"In this," said Jormund, "I agree with Aragorn. If you won't listen to us, Nasuada, at least listen to him."
First Nasuada said to Aragorn in a murmur low enough that no one else could hear, "Your training is indeed unfinished, if you are so blinded." Then she raised her voice, and in it Aragorn heard the same adamantine notes of command that her father had possessed. "You all forget that I fought in Fardandur the same as you, and that I saw the savagery of the Urgals. However, I also saw our own men commit acts just as heinous. I shall not denigrate what we have endured at the Urgals' hands, but neither shall I ignore potential allies when we are so greatly outnumbered by the Empire. My lady, it is too dangerous for you to meet with a Kull."
"Too dangerous?" Nasuada raised an eyebrow. "While I am protected by Aragorn, Saphira, Elva, and all the warriors around me?"
"I think not." Aragorn gritted his teeth with frustration.
"Say something, Saphira! You can convince her to abandon this harebrained scheme."
"No, I won't. Your mind is clouded on this issue."
"You can't agree with her!" exclaimed Aragorn, aghast. "You were there in Yazuak with me. You know what the Urgals did to the villagers. And what about when we left Tirm, my capture at Gilead and Fardandur? Every time we've encountered Urgals, they've tried to kill us, or worse. They're nothing more than vicious animals."
"The elves believed the same thing about dragons during Dufirnskulblaka."
At Nasuada's behest, her guards tied back the front and side panels of the pavilion, leaving it open for all to see and allowing Saphira to crouch low next to Aragorn. Then Nasuada seated herself in her high-backed chair, and Jormunda and the other commanders arranged themselves in two parallel rows so that anyone who sought an audience with her had to walk between them. Aragorn stood at her right hand, Elva by her left. Less than 5 minutes later, a great roar of anger erupted from the eastern edge of the camp. The storm of jeers and insults grew louder and louder until a single Kull entered their view, walking toward Nasuada while a mob of the Varden peppered him with taunts. The Urgal, or Ram, as Aragorn remembered they were called, held his head high and bared his yellow fangs, but did not otherwise react to the abuse directed at him. He was a magnificent specimen, 8.5 feet tall, with strong, proud, if grotesque, features, thick horns that spiraled all the way around, and a fantastic musculature that made it seem he could kill a bear with a single blow. His only clothing was a knotted loincloth, a few plates of crude iron armour held together with scraps of mail, and a curved metal disc nestled between his two horns to protect the top of his head. His long black hair was in a queue. Aragorn felt his lips tighten in a grimace of hate. He had to struggle to keep from drawing Zarok and attacking. Yet despite himself, he could not help but admire the Urgal's courage in confronting an entire army of enemies alone and unarmed. To his surprise, he found the Kull's mind strongly shielded. When the Urgal stopped before the eaves of the pavilion, not daring to come any closer, Nasuada had her guards shout for quiet to settle the crowd. Everyone looked at the Urgal, wondering what he would do next. The Urgal lifted his bulging arms toward the sky, inhaled a mighty breath, and then opened his maw and bellowed at Nasuada. In an instant, a thicket of swords pointed at the Kull, but he paid them no attention and continued his ululation until his lungs were empty. Then he looked at Nasuada, ignoring the hundreds of people who, it was obvious, longed to kill him, and growled in a thick, guttural accent,
"What treachery is this, Lady Nightstalker? I was promised safe passage. Do humans break their word so easily?"
Leaning toward her, one of Nasuada's commanders said, "Let us punish him, mistress, for his insolence. Once we have taught him the meaning of respect, then you can hear his message, whatever it is." Aragorn longed to remain silent, but he knew his duty to Nasuada and the Varden. So he bent down and said in Nasuada's ear, "Don't take offence. This is how they greet their war chiefs. The proper response is to then butt heads, but I don't think you want to try that."
"Did the elves teach you this?"
she murmured, never taking her eyes off the waiting Kull.
"Aye. What else did they teach you of the Urgles? A great deal, he admitted reluctantly. Then Nasuada said to the Kull and also to her men beyond, The Varden are not liars like Galbatorix and the Empire. Speak your mind. You need fear no danger while we hold council under the conditions of truce. The Urgle grunted and raised his bony chin higher, baring his throat. Aragorn recognized it as a gesture of friendship. To lower one's head was a threat in their race, for it meant that an Urgle intended to ram you with his horns.
I am Nargarjvog of the Bolvec tribe. I speak for my people.
It seemed as if he chewed on each word before spitting it out.
Urgles are hated more than any other race. Elves, dwarves, humans, all hunt us, burn us, and drive us from our halls.
Not without good reason, pointed out Nasuada. Garjvag nodded.
Not without reason. Our people love war. Yet how often are we attacked just because you find us as ugly as we find you? We have thrived since the fall of the Riders. Our tribes are now so large, the harsh land we live in can no longer feed us.
So you made a pact with Galbatorix?
Aye, Lady Nightstalker. He promised us good land if we killed his enemies. He tricked us, though. His flame-haired shaman, Durza, bent the minds of our war chiefs and forced our tribes to work together, as is not our way. When he learned this in the Dwarves' Hollow Mountain, the Herndal, the Dams who rule us, sent my broodmate to Galbatorix to ask why he used us so.
Garjvog shook his ponderous head.
She did not return. Our finest rams died for Galbatorix. Then he abandoned us like a broken sword. He is Dragel, and snake-tongued and a lack-horned betrayer. Lady Nightstalker, we are fewer now, but we will fight with you if you let us.
What is the price? Asked Nasuada. Your Herndal must want something in return.
Blood. Galbatorix's blood. And if the Empire falls, we ask that you give us land. Land for breeding and growing. Land to avoid more battles in the future.
Aragorn guessed Nasuada's decision by the set of her face, even before she spoke. So apparently did Jormunda, for he leaned toward her and said in an undertone, Nasuada, you can't do this. It goes against nature. Nature can't help us defeat the Empire. We need allies. The men will desert before they'll fight with Urgles. That can be worked around. Aragorn, will they keep their word? Only so long as we share a common enemy. With a sharp nod, Nasuada again lifted her voice. Very well, Nargarjvog. You and your warriors may bivouac along the eastern flank of our army, away from the main body, and we shall discuss the terms of our pact.
Agrat Ukmar,
growled the Kull, clapping his fists to his brow.
You are a wise Herndal, Lady Nightstalker.
Why do you call me that?
Herndal?
No, Nightstalker. Garjvag made a ruck-ruck sound in his throat that Aragorn interpreted as laughter.
Nightstalker is the name we gave your sire because of how he hunted us in the dark tunnels under the Dwarf Mountain and because of the color of his hide. As his cub, you are worthy of the same name.
With that, he turned on his heel and strode out of the camp. Standing, Nasuada proclaimed, Anyone who attacks the Urgles shall be punished, as if he attacked a fellow human. See that word of this is posted in every company. No sooner had she finished than Aragorn noticed King Orin approaching at a quick pace, his cape flapping around him. When he was close enough, he cried, Nasuada, is it true you met with an Urgle? What do you mean by it, and why wasn't I alerted sooner? I don't... He was interrupted as a sentry emerged from the ranks of grey tents, shouting, A horseman approaches from the Empire!
In an instant, King Orin forgot his argument and joined Nasuada as she hurried toward the vanguard of the army, followed by at least 100 people. Rather than stay among the crowd, Aragorn pulled himself onto Saphira and let her carry him to their destination. When Saphira halted at the ramparts, trenches, and rows of sharpened poles that protected the Varden's leading edge, Aragorn saw a lone soldier riding at a furious clip across the bleak no-man's land. Above him, the birds of prey swooped low to discover if the first course of their feast had arrived. The soldier reined in his black stallion some 30 yards from the breastwork, keeping as much distance as possible between him and the Varden. He shouted, "By refusing King Albatorix's generous terms of surrender, you choose death as your fate. No more shall we negotiate. The hand of friendship has turned into the fist of war. If any of you still hold regard for your rightful sovereign, the all-knowing, all-powerful King Albatorix, then flee. None may stand before us once we set forth to cleanse Alagaesia of every miscreant, traitor, and subversive. And though it pains our lord, for he knows that most of these rebellious acts are instigated by bitter and misguided leaders, we shall gently chastise the unlawful territory known as Cirda and return it to the benevolent rule of King Albatorix, he who sacrifices himself day and night for the good of his people. So flee, I say, or suffer the doom of your herald." With that, the soldier untied a canvas sack and flourished a severed head. He threw it into the air and watched it fall among the Varden, then turned his stallion, dug in his spurs, and galloped back toward the dark mass of Galbatorix's army. "Shall I kill him?" asked Aragorn. Nasuada shook her head. "We will have our due soon enough. I won't violate the sanctity of envoys, even if the Empire has. As you—" He yelped with surprise and clutched Saphira's neck to keep from falling as she reared above the ramparts, planting her front legs upon the chartreuse bank. Opening her jaws, Saphira uttered a long, deep roar, much like Garjvog had done. Only this roar was a defiant challenge to their enemies, a warning of the wrath they had roused, and a clarion call to all who hated Galbatorix. The sound of her trumpeting voice frightened the stallion so badly he jinked to the right, slipped on the heated ground, and fell on his side. The soldier was thrown free of the horse and landed in a gout of fire that erupted at that very instant. He uttered a single cry, so horrible it made Aragorn's scalp prickle, then was silent and still forevermore. The birds began to descend. The Varden cheered Saphira's accomplishment. Even Nasuada allowed herself a small smile. Then she clapped her hands and said, "They will attack at dawn, I think. Aragorn, gather Duvrangargata and prepare yourself for action. I will have orders for you within the hour." Taking Orin by the shoulder, she guided him back toward the centre of the compound, saying, "Sire, there are decisions we must make. I have a certain plan, but it will require—"
"Let them come," said Saphira.
The tip of her tail twitched like that of a cat stalking a rabbit.
"They will all burn."
Witch's Brew. Night had fallen on the burning plains. The roof of opaque smoke covered the moon and stars, plunging the land into profound darkness that was broken only by the sullen glow of the sporadic peat fires, and by the thousands of torches each army lit. From Aragorn's position near the ford of the Varden, the Empire looked a dense nest of uncertain orange lights, as large as any city. As Aragorn buckled the last piece of Saphira's armour onto her tail, he closed his eyes to maintain better contact with the magicians from Duvrangargata. He had to learn to locate them at a moment's notice. His life would depend on communicating with them in a quick and timely manner. In turn, the magicians had to learn to recognize the touch of his mind, so they did not block him when he needed their assistance. Aragorn smiled and said, "Hello, Oric." He opened his eyes to see Oric clambering up the low knuckle of rock where he and Saphira sat. The dwarf, who was fully armored, carried his Urgelhorn bow in his left hand. Hunkering beside Aragorn, Oric wiped his brow and shook his head.
"How'd you know it was me? I was shielding myself."
"Every consciousness feels different," explained
Saphira.
"Just like no two voices sound exactly the same."
"Ah,"
Aragorn asked,
What brings you here?
Oryk shrugged.
It struck me you might appreciate a spot of company in this grim night, especially since Arya's otherwise engaged, and you don't have Murtagh with you for this battle.
And I wish I did, thought Aragorn. Murtagh had been the only human who matched Aragorn's skill with a sword, at least before the Agaiti Blodron. Sparring with him had been one of Aragorn's few pleasures during their time together. I would have enjoyed fighting with you again, old friend.
Remembering how Murtagh was killed, dragged underground by Urgals in Fardendur, forced Aragorn to confront a sobering truth. No matter how great a warrior you were, as often as not, pure chance dictated who lived and who died in war.
Oryk must have sensed his mood, for he clapped Aragorn on the shoulder and said,
You'll be fine. Just imagine how the soldiers out there feel, knowing they have to face you before long.
Gratitude made Aragorn smile again. I'm glad you came. The tip of Oryk's nose reddened and he glanced down, rolling his bow between gnarled hands.
Oh, well, he grumbled. Hrothgar wouldn't much like it if I let something happen to you. Besides, we're foster brothers now, eh?
Through Aragorn, Saphira asked,
What about the other dwarves? Aren't they under your command?
A twinkle sprang into Oryk's eyes.
Why, yes, so they are. And they'll be joining us before long. Seeing as Aragorn's a member of Durgrimst Stingitum, it's only right we fight the Empire together. That way the two of you won't be so vulnerable. You can concentrate on finding Galbatorix's magicians, instead of defending yourselves from constant attacks.
A good idea, thank you. Oryk grunted an acknowledgement. Then Aragorn asked, What do you think about Nasuada and the Urgals?
She made the right choice.
You agree with her?
I do. I don't like it any more than you, but I do.
Silence enveloped them after that. Aragorn sat against Saphira and stared out at the Empire, trying to prevent his growing anxiety from overwhelming him. Minutes dragged by. To him, the interminable waiting before a battle was as stressful as the actual fighting. He oiled Saphira's saddle, polished rust off his hauberk, and then resumed familiarizing himself with the mines of Dúvrangur Gata, anything to pass the time. Over an hour later, he paused as he sensed two beings approaching from across the No Man's Land. Angela? Solemnbum? Puzzled and alarmed, he woke Oryk, who had dozed off, and told him what he had discovered. The dwarf frowned and drew his war axe from his belt.
I've only met the herbalist a few times, but she didn't seem like the sort who would betray us. She's been welcome among the Varden for decades.
We should still find out what she was doing, said Aragorn. Together they picked their way through the camp to intercept the duo as they approached the fortifications. Angela soon trotted into the light, Solemnbum at her heels. The witch was muffled in a dark, full-length cloak that allowed her to blend into the mottled landscape. Displaying a surprising amount of alacrity, strength, and flexibility, she clambered over the many rows of breastwork the dwarves had engineered, swinging from pole to pole, leaping over trenches, and finally running helter-skelter down the steep face of the last rampart, to stop, panting, by Saphira. Throwing back the hood of her cloak, Angela flashed them a bright smile. A welcoming committee. How thoughtful of you. As she spoke, the weircat shivered along his length, fur rippling. Then his outline blurred as if seen through cloudy water, resolving once more into the nude figure of a shaggy-haired boy. Angela dipped her hand into a leather purse at her belt and passed a child's tunic and breeches back to Solemnbum, along with a small black dagger he fought with.
"What were you doing out there?"
asked Oryk, peering at them with a suspicious gaze.
"Oh, this and that."
"I think you better tell us," said Aragorn, her face hardened.
"Is that so? Don't you trust Solemnbum and me?"
The weercat bared his pointed teeth.
"Not really," admitted Aragorn, but with a small smile. "That's good," said Angela. She patted him on the cheek. "You'll live longer. If you must know, then, I was doing my best to help defeat the Empire, only my methods don't involve yelling and running around with a sword."
"And what exactly are your methods?"
growled Oryk.
Angela paused to roll up her cloak into a tight bundle, which she stored in her purse.
I'd rather not say. I want it to be a surprise. You won't have to wait long to find out. It'll start in a few hours.
Oric tugged on his beard.
What will start? If you can't give us a straight answer, we'll have to take you to Nasuada. Maybe she can wring some sense out of you.
It's no use dragging me off to Nasuada, said Angela. She gave me permission to cross lines.
So you say,
challenged Oric, ever more belligerent.
And so I say,
announced Nasuada, walking up to them from behind, as Eragon knew she would. He also sensed that she was accompanied by four Kull, one of whom was Garjvog. Scowling, he turned to face them, making no attempt to hide his anger at the Urgal's presence.
My lady, muttered Eragon.
Oric was not as composed. He jumped back with a mighty oath, grasping his war axe. He quickly realized that they were not under attack and gave Nasuada a terse greeting. But his hand never left the haft of his weapon, and his eyes never left the hulking Urgals. Angela seemed to have no such inhibitions. She paid Nasuada the respect due to her, then addressed the Urgals in their own harsh language, to which they answered with evident delight. Nasuada drew Eragon off to the side so they could have a measure of privacy. There she said, I need you to put aside your feelings for a moment and judge what I am about to tell you with logic and reason. Can you do that? He nodded, stiff-faced. Good. I'm doing everything I can to ensure we don't lose tomorrow. It doesn't matter, though, how well we fight, or how well I lead the Varden, or even if we rout the Empire, if you, she poked him in the chest, are killed. Do you understand? He nodded again. There's nothing I can do to protect you if Galbatorix reveals himself. If he does, you will face him alone. Duvrangelgata poses no more of a threat to him than they do to you, and I'll not have them eradicated without reason. I have always known, said Eragon, that I would face Galbatorix alone but for Saphira. A sad smile touched Nasuada's lips. She looked very tired in the flickering torchlight. Well, there's no reason to invent trouble where none exists. It's possible Galbatorix isn't even here. She did not seem to believe her own words, though.
In any case, I can at least keep you from dying from a sword in the gut. I heard what the dwarves intend to do, and I thought I could improve upon the concept. I asked Garjvag and three of his rams to be your guards, so long as they agreed, which they have, to let you examine their minds for treachery.
Eragon went rigid.
You can't expect me to fight with those monsters?
Besides, I already accepted the dwarves' offer to defend Saphira and me. They would take it poorly if I rejected them in favour of Urgals.
Then they can both guard you, retorted Nasuada.
She searched his face for a long time, looking for what he could not tell.
Oh, Eragon, I'd hoped you could see past your hate. What else would you do in my position?
She sighed when he remained silent.
If anyone has cause to hold a grudge against the Urgals, it is I. They killed my father. Yet I cannot allow that to interfere with deciding what's best for the Varden. At least ask Saphira's opinion before you say yea or nay. I can order you to accept the Urgal's protection, but I would rather not.
You're being foolish,
observed Saphira without prompting.
Foolish to not want Kull watching my back?
No, foolish to refuse help no matter where it comes from in our present situation. Think. You know what Oramis would do, and you know what he would say. Don't you trust his judgment?
He can't be right about everything, said Eragon.
That's no argument. Search yourself, Eragon, and tell me whether I speak the truth. You know the correct path. I would be disappointed if you could not bring yourself to embrace it.
Saphira and Nasuada's cajoling only made Eragon more reluctant to agree. Still, he knew he had no choice. All right, I'll let them guard me, but only if I find nothing suspicious in their minds.
Will you promise that after this battle you won't make me work with an Urgal again?
Nasuada shook her head.
I can't do that, not when it might hurt the Varden.
She paused and said,
Oh, and Eragon?
Yes, my lady.
In the event of my death, I have chosen you as my successor. If that should happen, I suggest you rely upon Jormungandr's advice. He has more experience than the other members of the Council of Elders,
and I would expect you to place the welfare of those underneath you before all else. Am I clear, Aragorn? Her announcement caught him by surprise. Nothing meant more to her than the Varden. Offering it to him was the greatest act of trust she could make. Her confidence humbled and touched him. He bowed his head. I would strive to be as good a leader as you and Arjahat have been. You honour me, Nasuada. Yes, I do. Turning away from him, she rejoined the others. Still overwhelmed by Nasuada's revelation and finding his anger tempered by it, Aragorn slowly walked back to Zephira. He studied Garjvag and the other Urgals, trying to gauge their mood, but their features were so different from those he was accustomed to, he could discern nothing more than the broadest of emotions. Nor could he find any empathy within himself for the Urgals. To him, they were feral beasts that would kill him as soon as not, and were incapable of love, kindness, or even true intelligence. In short, they were lesser beings. Deep within his mind, Zephira whispered,
I'm sure Galbatorix is of the same opinion.
And for good reason, he growled, intending to shock her. Suppressing his revulsion, he said out loud, Now, Garjvag, I am told that the four of you agreed to allow me within your minds.
That is so, Fire Sword. Lady Nightstalker told us what was required. We are honored to have the chance to battle alongside such a mighty warrior, and one who has done so much for us.
What do you mean? I have killed scores of your kin. Unbidden excerpts from one of Oromis's scrolls rose in Aragorn's mind. He remembered reading that Urgals, both male and female, determined their rank in society through combat, and that it was this practice above all else that had led to so many conflicts between Urgals and other races. Which meant, he realized, that if they admired his feats in battle, then they may have accorded him the same status as one of their war chiefs.
By killing Durza, you freed us from his control. We are in your debt, Fire Sword. None of our rams will challenge you, and if you visit our halls, you and the dragon, Flame Tongue, will be welcomed as no outsiders ever before.
Of all the responses Aragorn had expected, gratitude was the last, and it was the one he was least prepared to deal with. Unable to think of anything else, he said, I won't forget. He switched his gaze to the other Urgals, and then returned it to Garjvag and his yellow eyes. Are you ready?
Aye, Rider.
As Aragorn reached toward Garjvag's consciousness, it reminded him of how the twins invaded his mind when he first entered Farthendur. That observation was swept away as he immersed himself in the Urgal's identity. The very nature of his search, looking for malevolent intent perhaps hidden somewhere in Garjvag's past, meant Aragorn had to examine years of memories. Unlike the twins, Aragorn avoided causing deliberate pain, but he was not overly gentle. He could feel Garjvag flinch with occasional pangs of discomfort. Like dwarves and elves, the mind of an Urgal possessed different elements than a human mind. Its structure emphasized rigidity and hierarchy, a result of the tribes the Urgals organized themselves into. But it felt rough and raw, brutal and cunning, the mind of a wild animal. Though he made no effort to learn more about Garjvag as an individual, Aragorn could not help absorbing pieces of the Urgal's life. Garjvag did not resist. Indeed, he seemed eager to share his experiences, to convince Aragorn that Urgals were not his born enemies.
We cannot afford to have another rider rise up who seeks to destroy us, said Garjvag. Look well, O Fire Sword, and see if we are truly the monsters you call us.
So many images and sensations flashed between them, Aragorn almost lost track. Garjvag's childhood with the other members of his brood, in a ramshackle village built deep in the heart of the spine, his dam brushing his hair with an antler comb and singing a soft song, learning to hunt deer and other prey with his bare hands, growing larger and larger until it was apparent that the old blood still flowed in his veins, and he would stand over 8 feet tall, making him a cull. The dozens of challenges he made, accepted, and won, venturing out of the village to gain renown so he might mate, and gradually learning to hate, distrust, and fear, yes, fear,
a world that had condemned his race. Fighting in Farthendur, discovering they had been manipulated by Durza, and realizing that their only hope of a better life was to put aside old differences, befriend the Varden, and see Galbatorix overthrown. Nowhere was there evidence that Garshvarg lied. Aragorn could not understand what he had seen. Tearing himself from Garshvarg's mind, he dove into each of the three remaining Urgals. Their memories confirmed the facts presented by Garshvarg. They made no attempt to conceal that they had killed humans, but it had been done at the command of Durza when the sorcerer controlled them, or when fighting humans over food or land.
"We did what we had to in order to care for our families," they said.
When he finished, Aragorn stood before Garshvarg and knew the Urgal's bloodline was as regal as any prince's. He knew that though uneducated, Garshvarg was a brilliant commander and as great a thinker and philosopher as Oromis himself. "He's certainly brighter than me," admitted Aragorn to Saphira. Baring his throat as a sign of respect, he said out loud, "Nar Garshvarg," and for the first time he was aware of the lofty origins of the title Nar. "I am proud to have you at my side. You may tell the Herndal that so long as the Urgals remain true to their word and do not turn against the Varden, I shall not oppose you." Aragorn doubted that he would ever like an Urgal, but the iron certitude of his prejudice only a few minutes before now seemed ignorant, and he could not retain it in good conscience. Saphira flicked him on the arm with her barbed tongue, making the mail clink together.
"It takes courage to admit you were wrong."
"Only if you are afraid of looking foolish, and I would have looked far more foolish if I persisted with an erroneous belief."
"Why, little one, you just said something wise."
Despite her teasing, he could sense her warm pride in what he had accomplished.
"Again, we are in your debt, Fire Sword," said Garshvarg.
He and the other Urgals pressed their fists against their jutting brows. Aragorn could tell that Nasawada wanted to know the details of what had just transpired, but that she restrained herself.
"Good. Now that this is settled, I must be off. Aragorn, you'll receive my signal from Triana when the time has arrived."
With that, she strode away into the darkness. As Aragorn settled against Saphira, Oryk sidled up to him.
"It's lucky we dwarves are going to be here, eh? We'll watch the cull like hawks, we will. We won't let them catch you while your back is turned. The moment they attack, we'll cut their legs out from under them."
"I thought you agreed with Nasawada's accepting the Urgal's offer."
"That doesn't mean I trust them or want to be right alongside them now, does it?"
Aragorn smiled and did not bother to argue. It would be impossible to convince Oryk that the Urgals were not rapacious killers when he himself had refused to consider the possibility until sharing an Urgal's memories. The night lay heavy around them as they waited for dawn. Oryk removed a whetstone from his pocket and proceeded to hone the edge of his curved axe. Once they arrived, the six other dwarves did the same, and the rasp of metal on stone filled the air with a grating chorus. The Kull sat back to back, chanting death songs under their breaths. Aragorn spent the time casting wards about himself, Saphira, Nasawada, Oryk, and even Arya. He knew that it was dangerous to protect so many, but he could not bear it if they were harmed. When he finished, he transferred what power he dared into the diamonds embedded within the belt of Beloth the Wise. Aragorn watched with interest as Angela clad herself in green and black armour, and then, taking out a carved wood case, assembled her staff sword from two separate handles that attached in the middle and two blades of watered steel that threaded into the ends of the resulting pole. She twirled the completed weapon around her head a few times before seeming satisfied that it would hold up to the shock of battle. The dwarves eyed her with disapproval, and Aragorn heard one grumble,
"Blasphemy that any but Durgrimst Quan should wield the Húthvir."
After that, the only sound was the discordant music of the dwarves honing their blades. It was near dawn when the cries began. Aragorn and Saphira noticed them first because of their heightened senses, but the agonized screams were soon loud enough for the others to hear. Rising to his feet, Oryk looked out toward the Empire where the cacophony originated.
"What manner of creatures are they torturing to extract such fearsome howls? The sound chills the marrow in my bones, it does.
I told you that you wouldn't have to wait very long, said Angela. Her former cheer had deserted her. She looked pale, drawn, and grey in the face, as if she were ill. From his post by Sephira, Aragon asked, You did this?
Aye, I poisoned their stew, their bread, their drink. Anything I could get my hands on. Some will die now. Others will die later as the various toxins take their toll. I slipped the officers nightshade and other such poisons, so they will hallucinate in battle. She tried to smile, but without much success. Not a very honourable way to fight, I suppose. But I'd rather do this than be killed. Confusion to our enemies and all that.
Only a coward or thief uses poison, exclaimed Doric. What glory is there in defeating a sick opponent?
The screams intensified even as he spoke. Angela gave an unpleasant laugh.
Glory? If you want glory, there are thousands more troops I didn't poison. I'm sure you will have your fill of glory by the end of today.
Is this why you needed the equipment in Orin's tent? Asked Aragon. He found her deed repugnant, but did not pretend to know whether it was good or evil. It was necessary. Angela had poisoned the soldiers for the same reason Nasuada had accepted the Urgal's offer of friendship, because it might be their only hope of survival.
That's right.
The soldiers' wails increased in number until Aragon longed to plug his ears and block out the sound. It made him wince and fidget, and it put his teeth on edge. He forced himself to listen, though. This was the cost of resisting the Empire. It would be wrong to ignore it. So he sat with his hands clenched into fists and his jaw forming painful knots, while the burning plains echoed with the disembodied voices of dying men.
The storm breaks. The first horizontal rays of dawn already streaked across the land when Triana said to Aragon, It is time. A surge of energy erased Aragon's sleepiness. Jumping to his feet, he shouted the word to everyone around him, even as he clambered into Sephira's saddle, pulling his new bow from its quiver. The Carl and dwarves surrounded Sephira, and together they hurried down the breastwork until they reached the opening that had been cleared during the night. The Varden poured through the gap, quiet as they could be. Rank upon rank of warriors marched past, their armour and weapons padded with rags, so no sound would alert the Empire of their approach. Sephira joined the procession when Nasuada appeared on a roan charger in the midst of the men, Arya and Triana by her side. The five of them acknowledged each other with quick glances, nothing more. During the night, the mephitic vapours had accumulated low to the ground, and now the dim morning light gilded the turgid clouds, turning them opaque. Thus the Varden managed to cross three-quarters of the no-man's land before they were seen by the Empire's sentries. As the alarm horns rang out before them, Nasuada shouted, Now, Aragon, tell Orin to strike! To me, men of the Varden, fight to win back your homes, fight to guard your wives and children, fight to overthrow Galbatorix, attack and bathe your blades in the blood of our enemies! Charge! She spurred her horse forward, and with a great bellow the men followed, shaking their weapons above their heads. Aragon conveyed Nasuada's order to Bardon, the spellcaster who rode with King Orin. A moment later he heard the drumming of hooves as Orin and his cavalry, accompanied by the rest of the Cull, who could run as fast as horses, galloped out of the east. They charged into the Empire's flank, pinning the soldiers against the Jeet River and distracting them long enough for the Varden to cross the remainder of the distance between them without opposition. The two armies collided with a deafening roar. Pikes clashed against spears, hammers against shields, swords against helms, and above it all whirled the hungry gore crows, uttering their harsh croaks, driven into a frenzy by the smell of fresh meat below. Aragon's heart leaped within his chest. I must now kill or be killed. Almost immediately he felt his wards drawing upon his strength as they deflected attacks from Arya, Oryk, Nasuada and Sephira. Sephira held back from the leading edge of the battle, for they would be too exposed to Galbatorix's magicians at the front. Taking a deep breath, Aragon began to search for those magicians with his mind, firing arrows all the while. Duvrangargata found the first enemy spellcaster,
The instant he was alerted, Aragorn reached out to the woman who made the discovery, and from there to the foe she grappled with. Bringing the full power of his will to bear, Aragorn demolished the magician's resistance, took control of his consciousness, doing his best to ignore the man's terror, determined which troops the man was guarding, and slew the man with one of the 12 words of death.